You're listening to Big Cast, your source for financial technology innovation with John Best.
Welcome back to another episode of the Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati on behalf of Best Innovation Group, where we like to do cool things with financial technology for credit unions, banks, startup fintech companies, established fintech companies, and we talk about it for anybody who may be interested in joining in the conversation here on the Big Cast with new content every Wednesday posted, and you can find it wherever you pick up your podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, or there's other places, let me know. Those are the ones I usually think about. And also directly at the website, big-fintech.com. Check that out as well. Also check us out at Twitter, Best Innovation Group, at Big Fintech. Myself, Glenn Sarvati. I'm with my own firm, 154 Advisors. And you can find me as well on Twitter at 154 Advisors. You can find both of us on LinkedIn as well. I've got an interesting interview today with, I think, a timely piece of information. Obviously, with the financial turmoil going on in the marketplace, a lot of people needing some additional assistance. A group called the Emergency Assistance Fund, which is a nonprofit 501c3 organization, helps employers help their employees with additional types of funding for a variety of purposes in times of need. We're talking to their president, Doug Stockham, as well as the president of the newly formed payments division of Deluxe Financial Services, the Deluxe Corporation. His name is Michael Reed. And they're providing a service to the Emergency Assistance Fund to help get those payments more directly into the hands of people who need them on a very timely basis. So we'll be having a conversation about that, as well as some excerpts from the recent digital town hall meeting. These are still taking place every Wednesday afternoon at the Big-Fintech website. And you can get an invitation and find more details if you go look over there. But we've been talking about best practice sharing and ways that credit unions can collaborate and help each other through the COVID pandemic. Interesting conversation this week about what I called a couple weeks ago the branch of the not too distant past, and the fact that all the changes we were making to get to the branch of the future suddenly don't really work in the new world around COVID-19. Things like, you know, no plexiglass and no teller windows with separation and people roving around with iPads. Suddenly that doesn't sound quite as good as it did all of, a couple of months ago. So we'll have a few conversations about that. And you can always, as I say, go out to the website and pick up the entire download and listen to the town hall replay in its entirety. I was planning on going right into things and for once not doing a bunch of current events. But, as luck would have it, I took a look at this morning's Wall Street Journal just before I sat down to record here on Monday and saw that the cover page of the business and finance section has a headline that says, "Virus Deals Credit Unions a Losing Hand." This is the Monday, May 18th edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm assuming it's equally prominent if you pick it up online, which, of course, I immediately felt the need to provide some editorial around. Because this is often one of the few places that people hear about credit unions, and I'm guessing that you may hear about this as well. So just to kind of understand it, bring the article to your attention, for one thing, and give you some talking points if you need to kind of get back to people. I'm sure I'm going to be hearing about it from my dad tonight, who only seems to ever ask me about credit unions when he sees something that's relatively negative, and it's usually someplace in the Wall Street Journal. So, maybe that's not fair. It's not an entirely negative article. It doesn't bash credit unions, but I do think it leaves some misimpressions. So I did want to kind of talk about that a bit. First off, it took me a second to realize that the title, "Virus Deals Credit Unions a Losing Hand," is a bit of a play because they use as their first example a credit union based in Las Vegas, Westar Credit Union, which caters, as they say, to the employees of Nevada's gambling industry. And the point they're making is that is a group that's been particularly hard hit, and therefore that credit union is going to find itself in trouble. So the point they seem to be making is one around concentration risk. They also point out a little bit later in the article that, and they quote CUNA on this one, I believe. Let me take a quick look. Yes, CUNA is quoted here as providing the information that 1 in 3 credit unions in this country are still tied to a single employer, industry, or association. Factually correct, I'm going to assume. I didn't know that statistic, but I'm assuming if they got it from CUNA, it is accurate. It seems to imply that that's, somehow an additional problem. And obviously, it's not a great situation if you've got too much concentration that way. But I'm not really sure how that's that much different from any small town community bank. Most small towns are fairly reliant on a single industry. Most credit unions, you can be a member if you're a spouse of somebody who was, in that field of membership, who probably or may not be in the same industry as well. So I'm not really sure how that is that much more of a red flag than a lot of other small community banks, unless you wanted to argue that we should really only have five big national banks that are fully diversified in this country. And I'm certainly not ready to make that argument. They also pointed out that although credit unions tend to be small, they very specifically call out Navy Federal Credit Union as being larger than many regional banks. Factually correct, once again. I would also say that that is cherry picking. Navy Federal, if you take a look, would qualify, if it were a bank, as the 30th largest bank in the country. I would tell you that you ask the average person, and if you wind up getting in a conversation about this story, challenge someone to see if they can name more than the top 5 or 10 banks. I bet you that the ones that are below number 20 are probably not household names to the average person. So the number 30 bank is not really all that large. Then you go to the second biggest credit union, State Employees Credit Union, is number 53 if it were on the banking list. The third one, Pentagon Federal Credit Union, would be number 77. One of the things, and I don't know if you want to consider this the definition of a regional bank, but the guideline for Dodd-Frank and whatnot was $10 billion of assets was the way that people thought about a significantly sized financial institution. There are 10 credit unions that are over $10 billion right now. First, I'll just throw it out there. Want to take a guess how many banks meet that qualification? You can ask somebody if they have the same thought. 10 credit unions, 145 banks. So compare those two. They do mention briefly the issue around car loans. I'm surprised they didn't make a bigger deal about that. Frankly, if I had something that I was going to be worried about is the concentration of auto lending. Not necessarily in terms of delinquencies, because, if worse comes to worse, there's probably still fairly good asset backing that up from a collateral value, which is not going to cause overly significant financial stability issues. But I think that the reliance on auto lending going forward, as we already were seeing people buying less cars, I think that's clearly going to be exacerbated now. That's not really part of the argument. And again, trying to be as intellectually honest as possible, I would say that that would be the piece that if I had to think about credit unions having a losing hand here, that might be the bigger piece that I would be concerned about. Anyway, it's like I say, it's not a terrible article. I just find it a little oddly positioned. I'm not exactly sure why it qualified as a front page story. But there you have it. If you take a look, again, Monday's Wall Street Journal today, Monday, May 18th, virus deals credit unions a losing hand is probably the best way to search for it. I'll put that in the show notes as well. You can track it down there. The other thing I'm wondering about is if Nike has suddenly got a sponsorship for the pandemic, because in the last week, I think I've seen 3 or 4 different presentations and conferences where people are now referring to the recovery as a Nike swoosh formed recovery. The earlier conversation was the V-shaped recovery that everybody was hoping for, that it was going to be a quick decline and then an equally rapid return. I'm now hearing everybody refer to it as the Nike logo, where it drops down and then starts coming back, and there's some swiggles and a long tail before it gets there. Probably pretty accurate. I'm not sure if Nike is happy to have that brand recognition or if they'd rather not have their name attached to this one. It's an interesting one. Anyway, enough of that. Back to the main topic today, the Emergency Assistance Fund, a nonprofit out of Florida, but it has international operations, actually. I had not heard of them until I came across this most recent story. Doug Stockham is the president. We'll be talking to him, as well as Michael Reed, who's the recently joined Deluxe Corporation as the head of their newly created payments division. We have spoken, just full disclosure, we've spoken to Deluxe before. I'm an alum of the Deluxe Corporation, spent a couple of years there and still do some work with them, spoke at their Deluxe Exchange Conference just in the last, earlier this year, back when we were doing crazy things like going in person to conferences. And we've talked about their eCheck solution. And the eCheck is the foundation of the Deluxe Payments Exchange, which is the new branding. And we'll talk about that a bit. And that is the backbone for the way that these emergency assistance funds payments and remittances are being made to people in need of rapid assistance. So with no further ado, let's listen to my conversation with Doug Stockham and Michael Reed. I'm joined today by Mike Reed, the president of the Deluxe Payments, the payments division of Deluxe Corporation, and one of their clients, Doug Stockham, who is the president of the Emergency Assistance Foundation. And I think, Doug, I'd like to start with you both. Thanks for both of you for taking the time today. But with everything going on with COVID-19, I think, Doug, what your organization does is particularly relevant right now. Can you just step back and explain? As I understand, your process works entirely through offering assistance through employers, correct?
Well, not exactly, but it's similar to that concept. So first, I want to thank you for inviting me to join you on this podcast. And then to describe what we do, we're financial first responders. So an employer would establish an employee relief fund and make donations as well as employees. And when those employees apply for a grant and meet the criteria, we make grants. So when employees face personal hardships, such as a medical bill not covered by insurance, or disasters such as hurricane or pandemic, then EF is here to help. And we do that by being an extremely efficient relief fund administrator, so that the vast majority of the money can go to those in need versus the administrative cost, which is overhead. We try to reduce overhead dramatically.
And from what I understand, though, in order for an employee to draw upon one of your funds, it is the money that comes from contributions from the employer and the employees of that company. They're each individual buckets.
Yes, that's exactly right. Okay. Anybody, we're a public charity, so anyone could donate to any fund. You or I could donate as well, but typically it's going to be people interested in that particular fund, which is the employees or the employer.
Got it. How many funds do you run?
Well, we have almost 300 funds right now, and in a normal time we had about three or four a week. Right now we're adding substantially more than that, as you can imagine, three or four a day, and it covers more than 9 million employees globally.
Globally, so it's not just a U.S. effort.
No, we started, we knew it had to be a global thing because many companies are multinational. So we actually have funds that have no U.S. presence, and we're growing that quite a bit. So about 5 to 7% of our grants are outside the United States.
So I'm picturing, you know, again, stepping back from COVID-19, in a typical scenario, am I thinking, you know, hurricanes, earthquakes, kind of more localized disasters, or is it more just financial need, individual hardships, medical situations, things like that?
It's both, but people pay attention to their hurricanes. We're all aware of them, or other types of disasters. But people, you know, every day have death in the family. They can't pay for the funeral, or medical bills they can't pay. Those are very common, almost like insurance. You can almost map out what percent is going to happen. Disasters, you can't. You can have a big hurricane, a little hurricane, a big flood. Those are localized. And those, when they happen, it's a volume of business as opposed to the everyday type thing.
Do most of your employers, are they, you know, very planful about having these set up in advance, or is it once a major event like a hurricane happens that they kind of rush and get these out so they can start getting relief to their employees?
Well, probably the most common thing is that the hurricane hits, they were totally unprepared. They said, we need to prepare for next time. Though during this disaster, as well as others, a lot of people rushed to finally do it. Though a number of them, paid 25%, are saying, you know what, we weren't prepared, we need to get prepared. We're going to prepare for the future. And so they're not trying to address this right now, but they're getting a fund set up anyway for the future.
Got it. So, and again, as you say, part of your benefit that your organization provides is the, you know, the ability to, on a very efficient basis, low overhead, you know, run these functions. I'm assuming the other piece is this is a not-for-profit, tax-free, so it segments the funds. So as opposed to, you know, probably getting some confusion if an employer directly advances funds to an employee, they kind of get commingled. This kind of keeps them very clearly cordoned off. Is that also a value?
Right. Yes, it is, because it's a clear donation, like you donate to any charity. It's now our money, and then we use it based on which fund to make grants to people who apply to that specific fund. But it's our money, and then it's not no longer the donor's money, and that way it's makes it a tax-free grant.
And then how do you typically, going back in time, and this is where we start transitioning into the approach through Deluxe and the payment exchange, how have you traditionally gotten the money out to the recipients? Is it a typically paper check? Do you do money transfers? How do you go about it?
Yeah. Well, our goal has always been to do things the quickest and cheapest. So in the United States, it had historically been a paper check, though Now, outstanding estates, it typically is an ACH or a wire transfer. And then sometimes we use gift cards, and sometimes we use PayPal or other types of things. And that's historically. But so we print, we actually produce the checks in other countries because we're a virtual foundation. And we email the check information in the United States where we print it out and mail it is what we used to do.
Wow. Okay. And I guess, and again, this is where, you know, figuring out the best way to do it from an infrastructure standpoint. Obviously, you're not a financial institution. That is an additional burden to try to put that together. So this is where, you know, Deluxe Payment Exchange comes in. And Mike, if I can kind of draw on you from here, I'm familiar, just full disclosure, I am an alumni of Deluxe Corporation. I spoke at the client conference, Deluxe Exchange, which is one of my favorite events back in February, one of the last conferences, unfortunately, I managed to attend before the lockdown hit in. But I'm familiar with the Deluxe eCheck, and it sounds like this is a natural solution. But Deluxe Payment Exchange, which is a new kind of branding, goes beyond that. It's the eCheck is just one component to what you're doing with the exchange. Can you say a bit more about that?
Absolutely, and thanks again for having me. We did rebrand the Deluxe Payment Exchange. The foundation of the platform is eCheck, which would allow a consumer or a business rather to send a payment to another business or a consumer and then be able to print the check or deposit the check in their bank account. We've expanded the capabilities, so now they can take those funds and put them and send them ACH, or they can go into a PayPal account or onto a Visa virtual card, and we continue to add additional options for the payee.
I like that. The point I want to just clarify, so it's a Visa virtual card too. So it's not just a matter of issuing a gift card like I see sometime, you know, FEMA will do or something like that. This is literally virtual, so you can use it online immediately.
That's right.
Great.
The funds are available immediately.
So how have you seen transaction volumes given COVID-19? Have you seen any significant changes in the patterns in terms of the use of the eCheck and the payments exchange? Not just for EAF, but more broadly.
Yeah, we have definitely seen tremendous increases in volumes. Volumes that we were seeing for individual customers for the month, we're now seeing in many cases that number of transactions per day. So we are seeing tremendous uptick in volume.
And from, you know, as you said, one of the keys is when someone receives an e-check, the person who is getting the funds, they have the option to actually print out the instrument and use it as a good old-fashioned paper check, or they can have it directly deposited into their account. Are you seeing a difference in terms of how many people are taking the various options, including the virtual card you mentioned?
Well, the dominant modality continues to be the check, or, you know, depositing the money using the check instrument. We are, though, seeing an uptick in the deposit services capability, which are the additional card types and additional modalities. So we are seeing an uptick there, but the vast majority still print and deposit the check.
Interesting, because I would have thought, especially with branches are closed, I guess you could always print it and then take a picture of it on your phone and use remote deposit capture, but it seems like you can still take one step out of the mix and go directly in through ACH, right? But I guess people haven't necessarily done that yet.
We are seeing steady increases in that, but and you're right. What they do today primarily, we believe, is print the instrument and then take a picture of it and deposit it, leveraging their bank's mobile app.
Old habits die hard. Well, we got them halfway down the path. We'll see how long it takes to get to the other half. So how did EAF and Deluxe come together? I'm not sure if that's a question for Doug or Mike. Who came to the other's attention first?
Well, I'll just tell you, it's an interesting little background. So when I was 15, I got a job programming computers for a bank, and I told them I was 18 because they wouldn't let me work if I was too young. And they paid you by check. You had to have a bank account, which I didn't have. So they created one, and the first thing I had to do is I had to buy checks and got them from Deluxe. So I know that brand from a long time ago. So what I was looking for is a almost like a check processor. And as I was looking for a check processor, was we were having to do too many, you know, print out mail things. I came across Deluxe. I knew the brand, so I was comfortable with the brand, and then looked at what they did. And so then I started experimenting with it myself personally. And then it worked great, in my opinion, and it's been a huge plus ever since.
So you were the one that figured out about the product and reached out to Deluxe. Interesting.
Yes.
And that brand, the brand equity really played into it. What are you seeing? How much has it simplified your life? I'm curious to hear how both overall, and I don't know how long it's been in place. I mean, I'd also be curious about your own patterns in terms of what you've seen about disbursements.
We used it for a couple of years. So this is just the thing of the logic. So what we do is we would create the check. And we'd email it to here in the U.S. Somebody would print them out, fold them, put in an envelope, and mail them. And instead, what we do is we download the in bulk the payment information, and then we upload in Deluxe in bulk, and they go out. So it's quicker, it's fewer steps, and it's because it's fewer steps and quicker, it's less expensive. So it's kind of a no-brainer. Also, people get the money quicker, so you have fewer phone calls of where's my check. And even though there's sometimes complication, like there's any system, the amount of complication we had with checks going out, people can't find the check, they weren't there. And you think about during the disaster time, people aren't at their home, they had to leave.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. I mean, if you're relying on the U.S. mail, if you're not at, especially if it's a physical disaster locally, you're not going to potentially be getting your mail.
Right. So this is far superior. It's quicker, cheaper, faster, and has less problems than the other ways. So I don't know that there's no other reason. There's no negative reason.
What's not to love?
Yeah, exactly.
What have you heard anything in both from, you know, specifically from COVID-19 and also more broadly in terms of reaction from your recipients? They understand the premise. They're handling it well.
Well, there's less confusion as time goes by. So what we do is we provide them kind of heads up FAQs. We give their all the employers I might call FAQs about what to do and how to do it. And so what I've found is over time, more and more people that cash checks are becoming aware of. They've seen them before. When they first see them, they don't know what to make of it, but then they start to see it. And so when I first started doing it, I said, well, I have to learn myself. So I basically, bills I paid routinely, I called people up and said, what's your email address? They said, well, I want to email you a check. They come back, wait, you can't email a check. I said, I just give me 10 minutes. Look. And then so, yeah, it's working. So I just start doing my own to some routine vendors. And then I do it individually from time to time with some other LLCs. So I use it myself because I feel like if you use the product, you can understand it better and you can understand better, you know, the pluses and minuses, what worked, what doesn't work. And I found it to be a very positive experience.
Mike, I'm curious, and you're new also to Deluxe. I believe you just joined earlier this year as the president of the payments division, correct?
Yeah, I joined in late November.
So can you tell me a bit more? Because the whole notion, I know there's been a reorganization as Barry McCarthy became the CEO. The whole notion of a payments division is new. Can you say more about your charge in terms of what you're responsible for and how that breaks out? In fact, very specifically, I'm aware that the payments division does not include the legacy check business, correct?
It does not include the legacy check business. Our business, my business, is in place to digitize check payments and check payment flows. So we are looking to find opportunities where today individuals are writing checks and bring digital capabilities forward that will allow those businesses to continue to send payments or to send payments in a digital way off of their systems. Much like Doug had just described, he sends us a file and we then use that file to send the transactions. And then it may ultimately result in a paper check, but fundamentally for the user, it's a digital transaction. And then the recipient can also take advantage of a digital option as well. So we've been focusing on those use cases quite a lot and then bringing other payments opportunities, other payment options forward to our customers. So things like payroll, merchant services, digital receivables, receivables as a service, things like that.
And as I've said before, I probably know a little bit more about this topic than a little dangerous on this. But my experience, at least from my time when eCheck was just getting started at Deluxe, it seems to be particularly gaining traction in B2B space. Is that still true, or are there more consumer-facing applications you're finding as well?
Well, right now, this platform and our capabilities do lend themselves to business-to-business payments, particularly if it's a one-off payment where the sender doesn't normally send a payment to the recipient. So we use this capability to help companies in the medical space send payments and property and casualty insurance, small businesses, but it's really valuable if it's a one-off payment where remittance data is required and the payee may want some choice in the way in which they receive the payment. So this allows for easy integration. It allows for us to send remittance data in a secure way with the transaction so they can reconcile the payment, and it allows the payee choice in the way in which they want to get the money, all in a much faster way than mailing a paper check, which today is the way of the majority of businesses still send one-off payments.
Right. Paper check. Makes a ton of sense. I'm just thinking of the one-to-many approach. Like you say, if you're habitually paying the same people over and over, it probably makes sense to exchange ACH information and all that kind of good stuff. But yeah, if you're not doing it regularly, this certainly is a logical solution. You mentioned before that eCheck is a subset of the Deluxe Payments Exchange. Similar question, is the Payments Exchange the backbone for everything you're doing in the payments division, or is that a subset as well? Are there other pieces? I'm just trying to put the whole picture together.
It is the backbone today for our disbursements engine. So we're using that platform to integrate with other technology platforms and providers to solve other problems in the market. So I mentioned medical payments. We partnered with Echo Health in the medical payment space and integrated their technology in with ours to distribute a differentiated value proposition. And so the value of the payment exchange is to allow us to take technology platforms and integrate them with us, for us to provide a differentiated proposition for our customers, or for platforms to take our capabilities and package it in with theirs for them to provide a differentiated proposition. So as an example, our capabilities are now integrated in with accounting software services for small businesses to make payments directly off of their accounting software service to a customer. So it complements that platform. And then, like I had mentioned, Echo Health, we've integrated in with ours, and we are promoting that in the market as kind of our answer to these problems in the market. Mm-hmm. So
again,
it's all about the platform.
The small business accounting, again, sounds like another natural. Yeah, I could see a lot of reasons for both of you that our listeners would want to get back in touch. Doug, Emergency Assistance Foundation, if people want to learn more, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, I think the best way is to go to our website, which is www.emergencyassistancefdn.org. And you can learn a lot more about it. Plus there you can contact, ask questions, or find out what you want, and we'll be happy to work with you.
Wonderful. And I'm just curious, you know, with a lot of credit unions and banks being among our listenership, do you have, are they among your clients who are providing these types of assistance?
Well, none of them are, but also so is all the credit card people, you know, MasterCard, American Express, and Visa. They all have funds.
Oh, they do. Okay, good to know. And you said also, I thought this was interesting too. So you draw, you know, the companies themselves make donations, charitable donations to the fund. Individual employees can make it, but just a layperson from outside those organizations, if they send you, if they want to make a contribution, do they make it to a specific fund, or do they?
We've had one donation to us as a foundation. That's not common. Most donate to a fund. So on our website, we have web portals for every fund that people can go to pick a fund and donate. And we've had some people, it's very unusual, but they said, you know, I like this idea so much, I'm just going to donate to this company because I like their stores. And they did.
Interesting. Okay, good. That's good to know. And Mike, the payments division of Deluxe, what's the best way to find out more?
Well, you can definitely find us at www.deluxe.com. Or, you know, you could get in touch with me at michael.reed@deluxe.com. I should also take this opportunity to say that we are also a customer of the EAF and have recently established a fund for the benefit of Deluxe employees. And we have so far had 100% contribution from our board of directors and the executive leadership team to support our employees during this time of need. And so, Doug, thank you for the platform and for our ability to provide those capabilities to our employees. And for Deluxe employees that may be listening to this, or anybody interested in helping a Deluxe employee, you can contribute to the fund and find that on our website as well, or on the EAF website.
Is there a drop down at the Deluxe website to go directly to the payments division? Or if people want to find out, and obviously you've got the checks division, the small business division, et cetera. Is there a way
there, there is a drop down for e-checks. So you would come to it through an e-checks drop down as though you were going to buy checks or secure checks. Perfect. And then there's also a payment section within the website.
Got it. One more question just came to mind. I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but Doug, in terms of the way each of these funds is administered, if the flexibility exists for the employer to decide, you know, percentage match, maximums, things like that, or is that somewhat turnkey for you?
Well, they usually decide that. We encourage matching because it encourages individual donations. The key to all this is to, people actually like to donate. A lot of people think the benefit is actually being able to donate more than getting the money. And it's always a way to communicate. And if you communicate by encouraging people to donate, people just hear differently and it really increases participation. So mm-hmm. That's the best way, is to get people to donate.
I'm thinking more on the other side in terms of the recipients. Is it a certain maximum, or is it you provide receipts up to a certain amount, or you get half of your funds?
Yeah, no, they usually they have a max grant amount. And then if they meet the criteria, they provide invoices, receipts that demonstrate the need, and up to the amount they can provide documentation, then we can make a grant.
And that's configurable by company, they can choose?
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, great, great stuff. I've learned a lot, and I think it's an interesting and a very worthwhile topic. Mike Reed, President of Deluxe Payments Division. Doug Stockham, the President of the Emergency Assistance Foundation. Appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Glenn.
So thanks to Doug and Michael for taking the time, and kudos for what I think is obviously a very noble effort. Take a look at the website. I think it's interesting. You know, as Doug mentions, most of the donations that come into this 501c3 are from actual employees of the companies who have set up the funds. But as he said, occasionally people will just make a general contribution that can be applied as necessary. And it's an interesting enough model that I think it's worth looking into. When I did a search on it, one of the things I came up with, one of the things that Google extended to immediately was, is the Emergency Assistance Fund legit? And lo and behold, before I talked to him, I was glad to see, yes, there doesn't seem to be any issue with them whatsoever. Anyway, on to, as I said, every Wednesday afternoon, the Best Innovation Group, along with CU Broadcast, has been hosting a digital town hall now, going back to when we first broke into this pandemic situation in March. For a while, there were two a week. They're now weekly on Wednesdays. I think this is episode number 14, or town hall number 14, that we'll be excerpting from today. And a good conversation that took place, again, as I mentioned, about the challenges facing the design of branches. And the whole direction that we seem to be moving branches toward kind of has to be rethought all over again. And now that we're starting to reopen business, albeit at very different paces, there's very different, you know, regional differences as you look at the way this is being done in different areas. It brings up a lot of fascinating challenges, both in terms of immediate reopening as well as how we're going to approach these things long term. The whole notion of shared branches comes back up. Drive-through banking, which has gotten more popular. And then in some places like California, where you don't see as many drive-throughs, you have curbside banking, which probably looks a lot more like some of the curbside pickup and delivery that restaurants have moved to in their time of need right now. And then the most interesting one of all to me is, I mean, all just think back, it doesn't take that far. I mean, two months, 10 weeks, something like that. Think about the idea of suggesting that people could walk into a bank lobby wearing a mask. It just doesn't compute. And now we're in a situation where people probably feel a lot less safe if they are walking around a bank lobby without a mask. It's just a real sign of the way our world has changed pretty rapidly and dramatically. So I'm going to play an excerpt of May 13th town hall meeting. You'll hear a couple of other voices along with John Best. Mike Lawson from CU Broadcast is in there. Jonathan Chile from Hudson Valley Credit Union is the first voice you'll be hearing speaking in detail about his credit union's experience around some of the kind of repurposing and restaffing of personnel as there's new bottlenecks in terms of where resources are really needed. So let's have a listen.
So yeah, we have some, we still have some fairly sort of manual positions, like the folks that process our mailed in transactions and things like that, that, you know, conceivably they could be in that boat where unemployment plus that extra $600 is going to make it a more attractive deal than potentially staying in the role that they're in.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I did a group of videos last year, and one of them was sort of how to prepare for AI. And I think it applies, which is, I think everybody's got to start thinking right now about what to do with, I'm going to use the word extraneous, but it's not a good word. I guess extraneous staff, where what's the next best thing for them to work on, and how do you cross train them and create, a more effective workforce? Because I love that, Cranes went through 2008 trying very hard not to have any attrition, not to close things, not to upset that apple cart. And, there is opportunity, I think, to transform all of those workers into something more valuable. The question is I don't think it's something that's always going to be, I think the first three things are going to be obvious, but the next 10, and that's the next 10 positions, aren't going to be. And so it may take some planning to start thinking about that now, to reach out to different areas of the departments at the credit union to say, hey, does anybody, feel like they're being overwhelmed in this digital transformation or transition? And could you use more help if there was capacity at the branches or those kinds of areas? And if so, what do you have in place to do training so that it's not, because the worst thing you can do is go, oh, we got something for you, and dump them into chaos and, have a bigger mess. Mike, you seem like you want to say something. Other than we can't hear you. You're just yakking.
No, I'm in total agreement with what you guys are saying. And just to this is obviously the understatement of the day is that this is going to change everything, staffing included, and how to have your staff more efficient. Like you said, John, just how to make them more effective, more efficient. And then this may create new opportunities for them too, So yeah. I think this is, there's that upside, like you said, John, just train them in this other area where they can have more opportunity to grow. Could be a change in their career path.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because I think Jonathan would agree, I know Kevin would, that these departments that suddenly need more capacity, they're used to adding like one person every 5 years. And so, they just toss them in the tank with the other fish and they sort of figure it out. Mm-hmm. Mass training a group on something that is, can be, for example, let's say that the Fed drops rates enough to make mortgages a real desirable thing in a way to try to get people to get homes. I don't know, I'm just making it up. And there's some sort of new first loan process or something. That whole group that does those kinds of processing in the mortgage space, that's a very specialized thing. And training it takes time, particularly if there's a new process, out there. So I think that's the lesson I'm hearing from Jonathan, is the success they've had has been by sort of trying to plan for this and see around the curve. So I'm sure others are doing it, but if you're not, certainly, I think you almost have to run a table talk game, Mike, that says, what would happen if we had to close A, B, and C branch? What would we do with those people?
Yeah.
And just start making, you hate to play those types of games, but, we do the same thing for, disaster recovery, business continuity planning.
Right. You're going to have to.
I think you got to game it out.
Well, that's what, Brett alluded to that last week when he said, 30% of the branches were going to be closed anyway, or something like that. So,
he always says that though. I'm surprised he didn't say 100.
the branch is dead.
I think the version of the branch we have is dead. I think John.
It's going to evolve. That's what I think.
It's going to evolve. Yeah, I think that's the difference. And what he's saying is that they're going to be less about, I think you said status quo, which to me is the, do you want to deposit or do you want to withdraw? And more about, okay, how do I make your financial health better? And here are some services we have to do that, because that's what we're going to be dealing with, which is a good lead into kind of our next subject here, which Kevin really brought up. Let's go ahead and spin up that slide. there, Melissa. So, you know, we were looking at a Harvard Review article that was talking about how do you lead your team through this, right? And they started to lay out these time horizons and these phases. The first one was the shelter in place, which we all experienced when in town halls 1 through 5, and in some cases ongoing into 7 and 8. And then we have this reopening phase, and that one's really hard because we literally just don't know what to expect, right? As we reopen branches, as we reopen things, particularly if you're in a hard hit area like where Jonathan is in New York. And this one could be a repeating loop where you're open, things are good, there's an outbreak, you got to close and back through it again. And what the results of that cycle are, I don't know yet. But, you know, I think you also got to keep that in mind that you could be looping through this several times. But then you get to this third phase, and it's this post-COVID-19 phase. And Kevin, I think you were kind of putting some thought into this, right?
Yeah, I think we're definitely still in the reopening phase and just really getting into it. But, you know, I think our jobs collectively are to think ahead. And to try and plan for what may be coming. And, you know, even we've talked a little bit about financial performance. You know, what's this going to do to your financial performance, and how long can you keep these extra employees on? And, you know, can you turn them into collections counselors so that they're able to kind of help take a credit union member friendly as much as you can approach to collections and trying to help the member through trying to get those payments made. You know, we talked a little bit about a few weeks ago, we talked a little bit today about branch planning. You know, all of us have heard the stories about the open concept branches. And so what are you going to do with these branches that have teller pods instead of a teller line and no bandit barriers, that's pretty much where you're going.
Yeah. And they're already doing it. People are putting up these plexiglass.
Oh, absolutely.
Jonathan talked about they were outfitting theirs. Jonathan, are your branches open again? Just real quick, Kevin.
So at this point, we have not opened the branches in what I would call any kind of normal capacity. We are in the next, and honestly, we're kind of having to play it by ear because of the way Cuomo is sort of reopening businesses in the state, even though we're technically an essential business. We're expecting to have all of our branch lobbies open to appointments in the next, I would say, week and a half. And then from there will be a gradual reopening of branches and sort of what I would call traditional lobby services. The issue though is, and honestly what we're thinking about, and this is, I'm sure, playing into other areas, is not only, you know, the disease and safety aspect there, but also the security aspect. You know, people being, you know, required to wear masks, you know, how do you maintain the security of your locations? How do you, you know, check IDs, all of that kind of stuff. So we're trying to really work through all of that before we open up to what I would call just sort of that traditional service model of a branch again.
So did you get the sneeze? Last time I talked to you, you were putting stickers on the ground and sneeze shields in, or whatever, the plexiglass. Did that get done?
So yeah, we have put in those types of barriers. You know, we've got the little social distancing icon, you know, graphics, iconography in and around our facilities so that, you know, people don't get too close to each other. So it's, you know, is it 100? I don't know. It's a good reminder. I think what's interesting around us though is that, you know, either the people are taking this type of guidance to heart, or they're not. And there are still plenty of people that don't seem to care one bit about the safety guidance for how to handle yourself and keep yourself safe during this thing. And I think that's the other challenge that we're going to have is, you know, when we do open up our branches to general lobby service again, just how hard of a line are we going to take, and are we prepared
To have your arm broke like the poor Target guy?
That's right. And I'll tell you, we've had at least one incident where thankfully it didn't involve our staff, but we had members at a branch, at one of our branches, get into a physical altercation not that long ago. So the tensions are running high, and people are not thinking straight in some cases. So we're very conscious of the possibility that there could be incidents when we do this.
You know, Mike was talking about Citizens Bank, and I think that Brett brought this up. Jill Castellia, she does lots of things, and I know Brett's on some different things with her, but they're doing curbside banking.
Yeah.
But coming back around, and this is where Kevin was going, I think, is do you require masks? And, you know, good news is you got a guy there with a gun usually, so that'll be easy to enforce. But, you know, I was wearing a mask, and I had someone say, you know, just go the freak home if you know, that's what you need to do. And I was like, dude, I don't, you know, okay. You know, it's hard not to punch somebody that says something like that. By the way, freak wasn't the word he said, but, you know, it's difficult, you know, we're going to really see that divide. And I do agree that, what are you going to do with that? So I was just interested to see, but Kevin, going back to you here, you know, just with that information, you know, where does that take you with some of these questions you have here?
Yeah. I mean, that's where I think, you know, different actions are going to produce outcome, and we're going to be trying to figure out which ones. You know, we've now encouraged drive up usage, and perhaps members are now more comfortable with it, so they stay there.
But you don't even have drive ups in California, right?
Right. We have, yeah. We're
so that's like, going to have to be curbside banking, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And most financial institutions, because we don't have drive ups, most of them, their branches were open, at least on a limited basis. And of course, you had to wear masks and that type of thing. But
yeah.
You know, there's the impact of cash usage. There's two sides of this story. There's the, you know, we've had members that, you know, we've raised withdrawal limits, and, you know, we, so you have members that are hoarding cash, not sure why, but worried about cash shortages. And then on the flip side, you have members who don't want to use cash because it's not the cleanest. You know, it's been through a lot of hands before it's reached yours. And so people are worried about passing the virus through cash. You know, the online and mobile, this is a great opportunity. And I think a lot of members have probably, out of necessity, made the transition on online and mobile banking. To the point where some of the providers had capacity issues. So, you know, what do we do to prepare? What does the future look like? Do those people stay in those in the digital channels, and or do they go back to their old habits afterwards? My guess is they will stay with their new, and you know, as long as those channels worked well for them, I think they'll stay. And then the last one, I talked a little bit about, you know, collection staff and guidelines. We talked a little bit about, you know, childcare and what that's going to be. You know, I've heard of collections areas that are actually going to job share and childcare share as well. So they're going to split.
How does that work, Kevin?
They're going to split the week. And so on Mondays and Wednesdays, you're going to take my kids and I'm going to go to work at the credit union. And the next on Tuesday and Thursday, it's the opposite. And on Friday, it's both are working from home days because those are non-meeting days.
That's really fascinating. You know, I was and my wife runs a company that does Department of Defense, Department of Defense staffing on big projects and things. And one of the stuff that's happened out here is they've had enough cases in a couple of the facilities, particularly the SCIFs, which stands for, you heard a lot about it during the impeachment process. It's Secure Compartment, something or other, information facility or something like that. But because they're small and they have a lot of distance, they've gone to what they call a gold team and the blue team, I think. And gold team comes in 1 week, blue team comes in the other, but they all get paid for 80 hours a week, but they only work 40. And I was like, how can I get that deal?
Yeah.
And I need to work for the government. But you make a good point on the staffing guidelines. But the other thing is, what about ramping up collection staffing? Because that was the game changer for us at Westcom when 2008 hit, was the decision to bring in, what was it? We went from five collections people to 80?
Yeah, and put in, a lot of technology, put in a dialer and, along with ScreenPop, the whole call center upgrade that took place. I mean, it was a massive change to get done in a short amount of time.
So there you have it. Just like that, another episode of The Big Cast. We'll continue to bring the things that we find the most interesting in this space, fintech related, banking and credit union related, and because it's top of mind for everybody in these recent days, most often COVID-19 related. Would love to say that that's no longer the case, but I think we'll be dealing with it for some time, and we'll be doing the best to bring you the latest thinking on that. We'd love to hear from you. Please drop a note. There's a place at the website, big-fintech.com, where you can listen to past episodes. You can also track down the digital town hall, as I mentioned. And as I said, if you're interested in hearing about when we have this new stuff out, you can count on us pretty much like clockwork every Wednesday with new content being out there. But if you'd like a reminder, please do subscribe to the podcast wherever you pick up podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Again, drop your note when you get a chance. You can find me on Twitter at 154advisors. Again, my name is Glenn Sarvady, S-A-R-V-A-D-Y. You can find me on LinkedIn and drop me a note there as well. Twitter for Best Innovation Group is at Big Fintech, big-fintech.com for the website. We'll be back with more good stuff next week. Until then, stay safe.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big Fintech, email us at info@big-fintech.com, or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.